All right. So, question. What was your favorite movie of 2020 and why was it Mank?
Okay, first off, why do you automatically assume my favorite movie was Mank?
Because, well, I mean, mind you, 2020, we didn't get a lot of movies, but the movie itself was really, really great. Like, I thought, I don't know, it was my favorite. Okay, I guess I'm just going to say, because it was my favorite, I assumed it was going to be your favorite.
Well, you're absolutely correct. It is my favorite movie, but still, I don't like the assumption.
Oh, okay, fair enough. But, Mank, directed by David Fincher, came out last year, 2020, and I'd heard about this movie. I think it was kind of hidden. He really didn't talk about it until, like, I read an article that said, directed by David Fincher, starring Gary Oldman, about the writing of Citizen Kane. And that just seemed like the perfect storm of a movie for me. I mean, is that when you first heard about it, or?
So actually, I first heard about it whenever you told me.
Okay, fair enough. That's probably.
There wasn't really much hype about Mank whenever it first came out, and I don't really understand why. I mean, big time director. I mean, of course, he's not new to Netflix. I mean, he directed at our House of Cards, but big time director, big time actor in Gary Oldman. Multiple big time actors in that movie. I just don't understand why Netflix didn't really give it a very much hype.
I often think that, and I don't want to sound pretentious, but it just seems like people like us, like the cinephiles, when we see David Fincher's name, we are like, oh my gosh, I gotta go see this movie. Like, this is gonna be a great movie. Whereas other people, they don't pay attention to the movies he's made. You know, like, I've asked people, do you like David Fincher? Like, who's he? And I say, well, he directed Fight Club. Like, oh, I love Fight Club. He directed Seven. Oh, I thought that was great. I was like, yeah, it's the same
guy. Yeah.
But I think David Fincher has a following, but with just the cinephiles are like kind of on board with everything David Fincher does.
Yeah. Right? And, you know, that's kind of easy to see. David Fincher is just phenomenal. And I think he pitched this movie to Netflix, and I want to say like April or May in 2019.
Okay.
And like they said yes. And, you know, he did an interview with Rolling Stone where he talks about this stuff, and he's like, I kind of feel like they gave me a blank check.
Yeah.
You know, to make this movie.
Well, because he pretty much started the whole streaming thing that we all know today. House of Cards was like I'm not going to say it was the first, but it was one of the first shows to do what it did, where it just threw everything out at once. It was like, here's your whole show. And I believe he directed the first two episodes of House of Cards. Mm-hmm. And then just a couple of years ago, he did Mindhunter as well. He directed a couple of those episodes. So I could see why Netflix was like, yeah, whatever you want. I think he said they gave him a 4-picture deal with Netflix. Like, whatever he wants to do, they're gonna put out there.
That's amazing. And considering, like, it took 30 years for this movie to get made. So this movie was written by his father. Jack Fincher.
Yeah.
So Jack was almost 60 years old whenever he started writing this movie. And he was actually a writer for a magazine in LA. He had written a few articles, couple screenplays, never really gotten into it. And then once he retired, he told David, he was, I think I want to write another movie.
Yeah.
And he started asking him for ideas. And then they were watching Citizen Kane. And Citizen Kane had always been his favorite movie, his father's favorite movie, as well as David's. But David turns to him and was like, you know, no one ever talks about the controversy between Orson Welles and Mankiewicz. Like, no one ever talks about that friction that they had.
Yeah.
And like, and you can hear, you know, David Fincher in the article say, he's like, you can kind of see the light bulb in my dad's eyes kind of flicker on. Nice. Like, okay, I dig it. And then it was like all downhill from there. And his dad, from what David was telling this, the interviewer, is like very task oriented and almost obsessive to a point. He recalls a time where a guy had showed him a card trick, and his dad like hounded him repeatedly, like, to show him the card trick, just keep showing him the card trick. And then he spent like 6 weeks just practicing and learning the card trick. Wow. And trying to master the card trick. And he was just like, he wouldn't stop until he mastered that one trick.
Nice.
He goes, and that's how he took every assignment for the magazine, and that's how he took most of his screenplays. He goes, but this movie was just like at a whole new level. Like, he was in and focused. And you can really tell, like, the research that was done about Mankiewicz for this movie.
Oh yeah.
Is like crazy good. Like, every little detail about him Like, he researched and found out, which was amazing.
And I read today that it was supposed to be made after the game, which was in 1997. And that's when Jack Fincher was still alive. And unfortunately, he passed away in 2003 at 72. I think they say it was cancer he had. And so after that, I could kind of see Fincher just being like, man, like, you know, like, my dad's not here to see this. Like, I want to make this for my dad, you know. But also Fincher wanted to make it for himself. But it was one of those things where it's like, man, if I can make this movie and, you know, when my dad's alive and he could see his movie on the big screen, that'd be amazing. And so it took all these years for him to finally get this movie made. Even though all these awesome movies he's done, it took him still this long to finally get this deal with Netflix where they say, okay, what's a movie you want to do? And it's no surprise that they gave him a blank check. And the first movie he said was, I'm doing Mank. Like, this is my dream project. I've wanted to do this for almost 30 years. This is my time to do it.
Yeah. So when Jack first wrote the script, the first script of the movie was like very one-sided. It was all about Mankiewicz writing.
It was very anti-Wells is what
Wells. But you know, and even David, too, he was like, I told my dad, he goes, that's very one-sided. He goes, there's something missing. There's an element missing. And then during that time, they started looking at the election year for the mayor of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, just going back into Mankiewicz's history, being, you know, a Jewish writer from Germany, being kicked out of Europe because of all the articles he wrote against Hitler prior to World War II, obviously, and then coming here and then kind of seeing the same situation, the same dynamic. And that's kind of what we see in the movie. You have the part where he's writing the movie for Orson Welles, but he's also like fighting against the system because you have the major, you know, millionaires who are influencing the politics of LA through the movie studios that he works for. And that's something that he's seen before and doesn't want to see again. So, you know, that element just made the whole movie rounded. And it's funny because when they pitched the idea in 1997, they pitched one of the studios was Universal. And I forget the second one, but the words, and according to David Fincher, again, this is all in the interview from Rolling Stone, the words that they told him literally was like, who gives a fuck? Like, who cares? Jeez. Like, that.
Who cares about this
subject? Who cares? And then he fast forwards to the meeting with Netflix and he pitches the movie to him. And then he's same kind of 30 years later, he's kind of hesitant about it. And the guys at Netflix were like, no, like, this is relevant today. Like,
yes,
you need to make this movie. Like, this is an awesome script.
Oh, yeah. And it's, you know, there's a structure to the movie. There's a certain structure to the film. And it took me, I don't know, it takes you about a couple of minutes into the movie to be like, oh, okay, I see what's going on here. And pretty much if you've seen Citizen Kane and you watch this movie, you could really see those parallels and like what's inspiring him to write the movie. I mean, you never see a frame of Citizen Kane in the whole movie because the movie is leading up to when he finishes the script. And it was such a fascinating look at the Hollywood system then, you know, like you had all these screenwriters in one room and like, all right, we gotta go pitch a movie. And they go pitch a movie. Yeah, no, okay, we'll come back later with something else. And they go do something else, you know, like it. And then you get this whole political climate also going on in the background. And it was really shocking to see the power that the millionaires had in this movie. There's one, it's William Hurst, how much power he had over MGM. And it's like, geez, are they still doing that to this day? Probably. I mean, we don't know. But yeah, like you said, you know, it was he saw that, and then you can really tell that that was the drive for Mankiewicz to really write this story. And what's really funny is, you know, you said Netflix gave Fincher a blank check. MGM also gave Orson Welles a blank check and said, write whatever you want about any subject you want, and we're going to put the movie out. No, who was it? It was a RKO, I think. Mm-hmm. RKO was the ones. Because MGM was trying to not make the movie come out.
So Orson Welles was like the hottest ticket in town in LA at that point in time in his career. And he, like you said, he had free reign to make whatever he wanted. And Orson, I mean, if you're not familiar with Orson Welles, he was just a big, big character on the radio during that time era, and he just transcended into film like there was nobody's business. Anything he touched was gold.
Yeah. And this was his first movie, like, which is insane to know that a studio was that confident. They said, whatever you do, we're gonna produce, we're gonna put it out there for everybody to see.
Yeah.
And the actor who they got to play Orson Welles, I've seen him before in movies, but like when you hear him on the phone at first, and when he's on the phone, I was like, that's Orson Welles. Like, I don't know how they got a voice, they got his voice to do it, but no, they had this actor play Orson Welles, and he played it just perfectly. Yeah, Tom Burke was his name, and he looked like him, and he sounded just like Orson Welles, and it was kind of eerie to hear that. but speaking of that, the cast of this movie with, you know, a David Fincher movie always has a fantastic cast. I mean, going all the way back, you know, to Fight Club and even Seven, you know, you everybody who's in his movies are just at the top of their game.
I mean,
yeah, Charles Dance was awesome. And if you don't know, Charles Dance played Tywin Lannister in Game of Thrones. And what's really cool is Charles Dance was in Alien 3. That David Fincher, that was his first movie he ever directed.
Yeah.
It was Alien 3. So I thought that was really cool that after all these years, they were able to work together again, you know. Charles Dance was amazing. Amanda Seyfried was awesome. And then, of course, Gary Oldman
overtook everything. You know, it's crazy. Like, so his dad with Jack was writing the script, and he was asking David Fincher for advice. And he was like, dude, he goes, I've directed Michael Jackson videos, Madonna videos, the Rolling Stones. He goes, I didn't know really anything about filmmaking. And he was asking me about this stuff. And so, like, you know, we were trying to piece it together the best we can. And then after they filmed Alien 3 is whenever they started pitching it around town.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. Like, and they were comparing, the interviewer actually was like, well, when you look at Mankiewicz as a character, does your dad kind of reflect that character the same way? And he was like, no. He goes, you know, Mankiewicz was kind of a disgruntled writer from New York. He didn't like what he was. He felt like he was at the bottom tier of writing. Mm. He was just writing, you know, crap to entertain people, like kind of like Gladiator. Like, are you not entertained? And his dad, Jack, he respected screenwriters and writers all over the place. He loved the craft and the art. He goes, so they are completely opposite people. Although they act the same way, they're very dedicated to what they do, but it's just, they're completely opposite.
Wow. I never thought about, like, when he wrote the script, if he was also as crazy as Mankiewicz was. And one thing I read in my research of this was that Jack Fincher wrote a screenplay about Howard Hughes being an aviator. And that script is kind of stayed in Hollywood to where when Scorsese did The Aviator, parts of his script were used for that film. He's not credited, unfortunately, but parts of what he was writing was put in that film, The Aviator, which I thought was pretty, cool at the same time. But this movie, you know, is a great film because, me being a guy who loves movies and a guy who wants to be in movies, it's awesome to kind of see that side of the business and to also see what Hollywood was like during that time, you know, during the
golden age of movies.
And it was grand. I mean, it's not like that anymore. I mean, sadly, it doesn't look as cool as it looked then, you know, but it was like everybody wore suits. Everybody was just
smoking and gambling and drinking and just living their best lives.
And then that was it. That was Hollywood. That was all it was. And then they would put together some movies and they would put them out there and people would pay money and then they'd get more money and then they would make more movies. And it's still the same today. But during that time, there was just a certain aura around Hollywood during that time. Mm-hmm. And I felt this movie captured it very, very well.
Yeah. And that was David Fincher's biggest thing. Like, he wanted to film it with all the, like, it was filmed in the 1940s. He wanted the movie to feel like it was found in a vault. Nobody had ever seen it before. And they were watching it for the first time.
Yeah.
And if you watch the movie, like, his techniques within the movie are exactly like that. Those little weird shots where you just see the back of somebody's head as they're talking to someone behind them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see the little pops in the film as the movie plays.
Cigarette burns.
Yeah. And they're all, and it's all digital. Like he didn't use any actual film, but the attention to detail to get that.
Yeah. And that's one thing I love about Fincher's films. And we'll talk later about Fincher and his movies, but how technically, detailed oriented he is with each of his movies. Like the amount of technology he's throwing into these things, even though Mank, it's a black and white film, what could he have done? Man, they did a ton of stuff to make that film look the way it did and sound the way it did, you know? And I believe they filmed it on a red, 8K camera is what they used. And what 8K allowed him to do was to zoom in, zoom out, do everything you want to without losing any resolution there. And there's no print of the film in color. It's all, the only print out there is black and white, which I think is pretty impressive. And the sound of the film is something to be, experience. Like, what was your, when you first started hearing the sound, were you kind of like, is there something different? And then after a while you were like, oh, I get it. Like, was that how,
yeah.
How,
so for me, like the whole, okay. So when I first started watching Mank, like before I watched that, I thought, I was like, okay, I know it's a movie about the making of a movie of Citizen Kane. Citizen Kane right now is sitting at the top of AFI's list of best movie in the world.
Yeah. The best film of all time.
Of all time. And it rotates between two other films, and we'll get to that list on a later episode. I'm sure we will.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, cool. Let me watch Citizen Kane first, and then I'll jump into Mank. So I watched Citizen Kane and I love watching it. But after you watch it a few, 10 to 15 times, it's kind of like, okay,
I'm sorry. That's my dog walking
around. Okay. Kit is allowed to walk around. Yeah, if you guys don't know, that's Kit. She's the mascot of three different podcasts right now.
She's awesome. All right. Yeah. I'm sorry.
So all good. So I watched Citizen Kane and then I jump into Mank and I realize, had nothing to do with Citizen Kane. Like, it has to do with Citizen Kane, but there's literally no reason to watch Citizen Kane before you watch this movie. It's all about Mankiewicz. And then the sound, I'm just like, for me, it was very immersive. Like I felt like I was watching a movie from that era. Felt like, just like David Fincher said, like I felt like this movie was locked away in a vault somewhere and Netflix found it and released it to the public. And now here we are watching a black and white film. And it's just like, I was in awe. I was like really in awe.
Yeah, I was really, and I had to look up how they did the sound, and what they did was now everything is in stereo. Like that's how everything is. You have multiple tracks on top of each other. One track is your dialogue, one track is your sound effects, one track is your music, and then other things. Well, with Mank and how things were done back in the day, everything was done in mono. So everything was put into one single channel. So everything in the movie is done on one channel. Your sound, your dialogue, your music is all there in one thing. And the how it sounds like compressed is really different. Like, it sounds like they're in a studio, because that's how they did movies back in the day. They didn't have the cool technology that we do now with sound effects. And it took me a second. And then once I heard it, and even when they're outside talking, you could still hear that compressed vocal. I was like, oh, I get it. And then, yeah, like you said, it worked. Like, it felt like I was watching a movie from that era. And it's kind of hard to do that today, because a lot of people will try to be like, yeah, it's in black and white, but ooh, look at the cool stuff we could do. Like, ooh, look at this camera angle they couldn't do back in the day. Whereas Fincher was like, no, I don't want to do
it. We're going to keep it all authentic.
I want to keep it all authentic and make it look as if this
was in that time period.
Yeah, and it was beautiful. I thought that was just a perfect way to do the film.
So 2020 was a weird year for everybody, right? We saw literally Hollywood stop. All the major studios stopped. All the major movie releases kind of got pushed back. Or not kind of, they did get pushed back. So, to your point, when we first started this show, Mank was really, I can only think of really like maybe two movies that were major. It was Mank and Tenet that came out in 2020 that were really the major movies. Everything else was very, those were the oddball directors or actors that working on projects that they they didn't have a chance to make, and you know, these streaming services are giving them a chance to do it because there's nothing out right now. So yeah, Mank is already nominated for 3-6 Golden Globe Awards. Drama, best drama motion picture, best director in a motion picture, best actor in a drama motion picture, best screenplay in a motion picture, best supporting actress in a motion picture, and best original score. And they are going to win all six of those categories. You think
they're actually going to win all six of them? I was impressed that they didn't do a supporting actor for Charles Dance.
Yeah.
Or for that guy who played Louis B. Mayer. That guy's awesome. That guy's been around a long time. But Amanda Seyfried did like the best I've ever seen her do in a movie ever. Although I thought Lily Collins was also really, really great in the movie. And then of course, Gary Oldman, he's probably going to win.
He's going to win best actor. The screenplay is going to be, they're going to win best actor, best original screenplay. And David Fincher is going to win best director.
I think he's finally, and that's a crazy thing, y'all. David Fincher has never won an Oscar or Golden Globe. Like, I don't know what it is about his movies that they're just like, nah, don't worry about it.
Yeah. You
know?
I think this is the movie that's going to get him over that hump. And I think it's going to transfer over to the Oscars as well, because Mank is going to run the table. If you've watched it and you're like, well, I don't understand what these guys are talking about, go back and watch it again and just really watch it.
I watched it again the second time today to prepare for this, this podcast, and it got better the second time. Like it's not long, but it is over 2 hours long. So I can see how people are like, oh, it's too much. But I don't know, watching it again, it's just, the story is so great. It's so well told. And you know, one thing I told a few buddies of mine who are also pretty big movie buffs, I said, when you watch Mank, you can really see Fincher putting a lot of heart into it. And you know, it's a very, very well made movie, and it doesn't feel like other Fincher films.
No,
you know,
absolutely not.
So speaking of Fincher films, okay, what was your first Fincher film like experience? What was your first? Seven was your first one?
Seven was my first one. And don't ask me why it was my first one, but it was my first one.
So we were young when that movie came out. All right. So did you watch it when it came out? Or?
Yeah, I did.
Oh my gosh.
That's how traumatic my childhood was.
Jeez. Well, I know that movie, The Butterfly Effect, they showed scenes from it. I think that was my first ever like glimpse of the movie Seven, was The Butterfly Effect, oddly enough. And I think I had seen the ending already on TV, like a made for, you know, the edited TV version of it.
I just remember the gluttony part, and then the last part when Brad Pitt's freaking out, what's in the box? What's in the box?
Yeah, now that's such a parodied, you know, line, but man, at the time, like, it's like, holy crap.
I remember watching that movie and just being not scared, not upset, but just like, holy crap. Like, what did I just watch? Like, that experience of that movie just like really just kind of changed a lot in me.
Oh yeah.
I mean, don't let your kids watch that
movie. Yeah, yeah. Wait till they're older to watch it.
Seven. I mean, he has better movies to watch. I mean, let him watch Lords of Dogtown or something, which is a great, great flick for anybody to watch if you haven't seen that
one. But that's not his though, is it?
Yeah, it is.
No, really?
Yeah.
How? No way.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Lords of Dogtown.
Are we going to fight right now? We're going to fight?
We are going to fight.
All right.
I already have it up. Here we go.
I think you're, I don't know if I'm okay with your detective skills.
Lords of Dogtown, 2005.
He did not direct that.
It's on his movie list.
Well, maybe he produced it, but I don't think he directed it. He produced it. He produced it.
Okay. It's still one of his movies.
It is still one of his movies. Which is a very random movie for him to be.
I'm right and wrong at the same time.
Yes. But my first experience with David Fincher was Alien 3 without knowing it was David Fincher.
Yeah.
I think I'd been told growing up, like, it's not the best one. And I watched it and I was kind of like, oh, this movie sucks, man. I didn't like it at all. And then when The Curious Case of Benjamin Button came out.
I love that movie.
I fell in love with that movie. And then I was like, wait a minute. He directed Zodiac. I was like, I've seen Zodiac. I was like, let me watch Zodiac. I didn't like it when I first watched it. Then I watched Zodiac again. And I was like, oh, this movie's awesome. And then that movie, I think Zodiac might be one of his best that he's ever done.
So I think one of his best that he's done is kind of underrated. is Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Dude, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was spectacular.
Dude, amazing movie. So, fun fact, after he just got done filming Seven, was it Seven? I think it was Seven. After he got done filming Seven, Kathleen Kennedy actually approached David Fincher to make the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And David Fincher turned her down. He told her, I don't know if it was either before Seven or after Seven, but Kathleen Kennedy approached him first to make it. And then he said, no, he goes, I don't see the story of a bisexual hacker and a degraded writer solving a crime together going very far. But then years later, I think a Norwegian producer bought the rights to
the Swedish producer bought
the rights to the movie. And they, okay, that Kathleen Kennedy happened before Seven. After Seven, they approached him again and David Fincher was on board with it. And it came out, and with the idea that it was going to be like, okay, this is going to be like an adult drama kind of trilogy series just based off the books.
Yeah.
And it was completely different than the books. but when it came out, it came out at a time, I think it came out in 2010. And that year they had Iron Man 2. They had a couple other big movies. No, it came out 2011, but
yeah,
2010, 2011, there was a lot of big movies coming out then. So it kind of got pushed to the back.
Yeah, it got very pushed aside.
Yeah.
And I also, the content of it, and there's a horrible scene in the movie itself. And I know a lot of people were just anti that movie. And plus, Rooney Mara. Yeah, Rooney Mara. She's amazing, but she wasn't a household name.
Yeah, but she got nominated for an Oscar for that.
She got nominated for an Oscar for that. Daniel Craig was in the movie. Christopher Plummer. And like every actor in that movie did a fantastic job in that film. But it just wasn't promoted well. Mm-mm. I watched it the night before it even came out. Like there was a special thing going on and I was just blown away by it. And unfortunately, like Rudy said, it got kind of overshadowed to the point where they didn't make a sequel. They didn't do the second or third in the series, which they were all.
Well, they did. They did the second. I think.
The studio went ahead with the second movie without Fincher.
Yeah.
And but it wasn't even the second movie. It was another book in the series. But anyway, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I thought was a very great film. But when it comes to Fincher's like best, it's Zodiac for the Curious Case of Benjamin Button, but Fight Club. Fight Club is just out of this world.
Fight Club great. Is like literally on my list of top.
It's 15. In my top 10 movies of all time.
I was going to say top 15.
Oh, okay.
I have a lot of movies, but top 15, top 10 movies of all time, Fight Club. Edward Norton, Brad Pitt, again, just. There's nothing we can say about Fight Club that nobody.
Everyone's always talked about Fight Club, and Fight Club was a movie that.
What's your favorite scene?
My favorite scene in Fight Club.
Yeah.
I know it sounds bad, but I love the ending shot. Like more than anything else,
when they're standing there watching the buildings collapse,
that's just such an iconic. Like, wow, I have a problem. You know, like that moment where he says, "You met me at a very strange time in my life, Marla." Like, I was just. And it's such a funny line because of what they're doing out that side and all the buildings blowing up. And plus that song comes on, Where Is My Mind? And I think that's probably my favorite scene of that whole movie.
Mine is when they're driving down the highway and Brad Pitt looks over, tells the dude to let go of the wheel. And he just stares at him as the car drifts off the freeway.
Yeah. And they get into that crazy accident. So there's a funny story where when they were cutting the movie together, the editor was like, "Oh, well, okay." And Fincher was like, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, there's a problem with the continuity." He goes, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, okay, so, you know, Brad Pitt's in the driver's seat, Edward Norton's in the passenger seat." He goes, "Yeah, but when the car crashes, it's reversed. You didn't realize that. And now it looks like Edward Norton was driving and Brad Pitt was in the passenger seat." And he's like, "Yeah, just wait." And then at the end of the movie, you realize, oh, it was Edward Norton driving.
The whole time.
And there's so many crazy like hints they did in that movie, mm-hmm. that if you're not paying attention, you're going to miss them, you know? And so that movie, it's one of those movies that people, whenever they hear the title of it, they're automatically like, oh, I don't want to watch that. It's about fighting. And I'm like, they don't even fight much in the movie. Mm-mm. And
it's about so much more than that.
And the way I explained Fight Club to people, they're like, so what's it about? I was like, it's about a guy who has trouble sleeping. That's the only thing I tell people. And like, really? I was like, that's it. If you really think about the movie Fight Club, it's about a guy who had a trouble sleeping. And this is where it took him.
And it escalated very fast. And then we're not even talking about The Social Network.
The Social Network, and I called it back then, but a lot of people were kind of like, that's too much. I said The Social Network is the Citizen Kane of our generation. And I think
it's a little much.
It's a little much.
It's a little much.
But not in the grandiose, it's a movie you have to watch. Actually, kind of is for me. But the storytelling is almost the same as Citizen Kane, where you have a guy at the end of the movie who has all this wealth, all this success, but at the end, he's still alone. And it's that classic story of you're striving, you get it, and then that's it, it's over. And so for me, The Social Network was that type of story where it was like a modern day Citizen Kane. It's written by Aaron Sorkin, and the cast, again, is insane in The Social Network. And I love that movie. Like, when I first watched The Social Network, I didn't like it. I hated it. I was like, that was really lame. And then I was at work, ironically, just sitting down thinking about it. And I was like, I should have liked it. It was a Fincher movie. It's written by Aaron Sorkin. Why didn't I like it? And the more I thought about it, I was like, wait, I'm stupid. That was amazing. Like, I went back and watched it again, and just to confirm, I was like, "Oh, this was one of the best movies." what was your opinion about The Social Network?
I absolutely loved it. I mean, it came out at a time where literally Social Network was blowing up in the literal sense, and for us to kind of get that inside glimpse on how, you know, Facebook came to be.
I mean, so supposedly
came to be, like to see it. Like, it was an amazing, I loved The Social Network.
And it was supposed to win Best Picture that year and Best Director, but then The King's Speech won.
King's Speech. Well, The King's Speech was a great movie.
It was a great movie, but let me ask you a question. When's the last time you watched The King's Speech? When's the last time you watched The Social Network?
Like, Social Network, I watched that a couple months ago. The King's Speech, I watched that whenever it came out.
Exactly. All right. We'll talk about Oscars the closer we get to Oscar season and why it's kind of like that. But The Social Network was really good. And the next year he followed it with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is a really quick turnaround for a director.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what was really cool was the editors won both years for The Social Network and for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And I'm a kind of an editor, so I like to watch Fincher's movies when he's talking about his editing process, and he does crazy things in the editing that it blows me away. So we talked earlier how Mank was filmed in 8K, right? Some of his movies are filmed in 6K, and what he does with that is he's able to punch in closer. Like, he can have the camera back and then he can say, no, I want to be a little bit closer, and he can punch in and not lose any resolution, which is fantastic. And then he can even say, you know what, you know, this guy did really good on this take, but the person he was acting against did better on that take with the response. Take him out of this take and then bring him in from this take and put him here. And then they splice it together and there you go. And
so it's funny that you say that, because one of the things that David Fincher is criticized about is the number of takes that he does. It's
yes.
Like, for instance, Mank. The scene where Gary Oldman walks into the dinner party drunk, sits at the end of the table and starts yelling at everybody, right? And then eventually ends up vomiting and getting kicked out of the party, right?
Yeah.
Great scene.
Great scene.
Fantastic scene. Gary Oldman knocks it out of the park. So they did 12 to 14 takes for every setup.
Cool.
And they did 40 setups.
And if you don't know, in Hollywood, setting up for one shot takes a while.
They did 40 setups. At 10 to 12 takes per setup. And so he addresses this, and it's funny because I had this sitting in my back pocket. I'm like, ooh, I'm gonna talk about this, and James is gonna be impressed.
Okay.
And then before we get on, we have a couple slices of pizza, and he puts on Gone Girl with the commentary.
It's amazing.
It's, he's talking about the takes. You know, he's using the second take. So he was like, tell everybody to F off.
It's awesome.
It was, it's an amazing commentary of the movie. But then reading this one, and they do that, and he addresses the issue. He's like, look, he goes, I do those mini takes, one, because of the editing process. I'm able to pull from different takes because I like different things about each one. He goes, but also he wants the thing to be natural. He wants the actors to come out and just be natural with it.
Yeah.
And so he goes, sometimes you can get that in the first take, depending on who your actors or actresses are. He goes, sometimes it takes a few takes. So, you know, he goes, but if you're doing 14 takes and you're using take 12, that's not too bad.
Yeah.
If you're doing 14 takes and you're using take two, you might have an issue.
Wow. And that makes sense, though. I mean, that means you wasted all that time, and whatever they were doing, they weren't giving it to you. And I heard, I think Jesse Eisenberg, you know, because he also has experience in theater, and he says, you know, when you do theater, you know, you rehearse and you go out there and you give a performance, and then the next day you can probably do a different type of reading of that line and get a different, you know, you can play with it more. Whereas in film, you do a couple of takes and they're just like, okay, that's it. He said, but with Fincher, when they did that, especially that opening shot of The Social Network, which is an amazing, between Jesse Eisenberg and Rooney Mara, they said they did 99 takes of that shot. And he said each take felt different. It felt like we were doing something different each time we were going through. Mm-hmm. And that scene's amazing, and it's awesome. And there's another scene where it was a line of Jesse Eisenberg saying, did I use any of your code on Facebook? Do you see any of your code on Facebook? And he did, I forget how many takes of that, but each one was different. And for an editor and as for a director, that's perfect, because then you can go through and you can go, oh, that's my take. That's the one I want. And it's like, but for the actors, I think Gary Oldman was also like, dude, this is, and Gary Oldman's a professional. Gary Oldman's the man. And even he was like, dude, you gotta calm down here, man. Like, you're filming Amanda Seyfried looking at me walking into a room for like 8 hours. She has no line of dialogue, but you're just like, okay, try it this way. Okay, now do it this way. Do it that way. And have you ever seen a behind the scenes with David Fincher when he works like on a movie? No. It's intimidating. Like, even as somebody watching just a making of it, it's so intimidating because he knows every job on set, every person on set. He knows what their job is.
And he knows how to do it better
than them. He knows how to do it better than them. That's what Andrew Garfield made the joke where he says it's intimidating working with a director who's like that, and who can probably do a better job acting as well, better than you can. And it's the amount of detail Fincher puts toward it, and you can tell that that's how he runs his sets, where he's like, no, this is how I want it to be. And one thing I never knew was when they did The Social Network, he sat down with Aaron Sorkin, an assistant, and the actors, and they went through each line of the movie, and he says, okay, why? Like, what does this mean? Why would he say it like this? Why would he say it like this? And Sorkin, I'm pretty sure, was like, oh my gosh, dude, like, I have to go through my entire script and just, and they went through and he made sure each line was perfect before he even filmed a single frame of The Social Network.
Yeah, it's crazy to me that these guys have this kind of mindset. Like, they have this mindset and this attention to detail that they're gonna focus on every little minute thing.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And it's going to make it that much better. And, you know, when you watch his movies and you're realizing, okay, oh God, I love this scene, or I love this line, or I love how that actor delivered that. And then when you think about that, you're like, I wonder how much work actually went into that.
Yeah. Now I watch his movies very carefully. And I saw a podcast that was on TikTok where they said even the spacing, like how he frames his actors, he does that on purpose because, like we said, you know, how much work went into it. He could be like, oh, well, this actor in the middle wasn't that good on this take. I want to take him out. And then I have enough space, because what he does is he'll lock the camera in place, meaning he puts the tripod there, puts the camera on it, and he hardly ever handholds anything. If you ever watch a Fincher film, and that's only because he has that freedom when he's editing to start messing around with the frames. And it blows me away now, knowing that, to watch, like you said, watch those movies, be like, gosh, how many times did he have to do this take to get that part, you know? And
can you imagine, like, the interview process for his editor? Like, okay, dude, This is what we're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
you know what I mean? Hey.
Quiet.
Hey,
it's cool.
Enough of that.
Yeah. Well, I heard one of his editors say, like, they love that they don't have to worry about. I'm sorry. The mascot is having a great time today. Hold on.
Hey. Psst.
She just wants to be part of the action. One of his editors was talking and they said they like Fincher's movies because there's never a moment when they're editing that they're like, oh man, like you missed that. Oh man, you missed this angle. Oh, it would have been really cool if you got. No, he says, here's my scene and every single angle is covered and you have enough takes per coverage to where they can flesh out an entire scene perfectly. And that blows me away that he thinks of all of that before, you know, they even start filming a single frame.
Yeah, that's just, it's just insane to me. Absolutely insane. And again, Mank and David Fincher is for 2020 is probably setting the bar for whatever's coming out next.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
Like there, I haven't really seen any other movie trailer other than what WB's releasing on HBO and
like Dune, theaters. You know.
Yeah, like I mean, Dune. I know you were super excited about Dune.
Oh, I don't want to talk about Dune. I'm still upset about Dune because I should have already watched Dune at the time of this podcast.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna throw that out there. But another good David Fincher film that I love is, and we mentioned it earlier, was The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. I thought that was just such a beautifully made movie, and he was kind of nervous about it because there's no antagonist, there's no crazy like climax of the story. It's just this life, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and Brad Pitt's in there, Cate Blanchett, Tilda Swinton. I mean, the cast is amazing. The technology that was put into this film is that made way for, I think, Avatar to do what they did. Mm-hmm. And it was insane when I first saw like that teaser trailer of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. I was like, what is this movie? You know? And when I watched it, I fell in love with it immediately. That was my favorite movie of that year. The Dark Knight also, but The Curious Case of Benjamin Button was high up there with what I thought was a great movie. And then I went back and watched Alien 3 just so I could be like, all right, what happened? And if you ever hear about the production of Alien 3, it's amazing that David Fincher even stayed a director. Because any other director, their first movie having that experience would have just been like, no, I don't want to be in Hollywood. Have you ever heard the struggle that happened with that movie?
No, go ahead.
Please. So here's what happens, man. Like he's a hot director of music videos, Madonna, Michael Jackson. I mean, he directed some
the Rolling Stones, massive pictures.
Yeah, he did some crazy music videos.
And he talks. They ask him about it sometimes. He's like, "Well, man, this is a great video." He goes, "Well, yeah, it's Michael Jackson."
Yeah, it's like, well, it's Madonna. Like, they made it good. I just had to make sure the camera was in the right place, you know, and. So he gets the job to direct Alien 3, which is a huge
undertaking.
Yeah. Undertaking because it followed Alien, Aliens, and now Alien 3. And he had a script, and I believe the script he had was like, this is what I'm doing. Like, this is the movie I'm going to make. And the studio just kept changing the script to the point where the teaser trailer didn't make any sense anymore because it said in 1978 or 9, we found out why no one in space can hear you scream. This year, you'll find out why no one on Earth can hear you scream. And it was Alien 3, and it shows Earth, and it's supposed to take place on Earth, you know? And the course of the movie, that didn't happen. They changed it up on him. And so they're building all these sets, and then they're like, oh, we're doing this instead. And he was like, well, what about my sets? Like, oh, you can still use them. So if you ever watch the movie, there's two different sets that he's using to try to make it all make sense. And he had an idea on how to do the xenomorph, the alien, which was the old school way of using like a puppet pretty much, like, and they built this amazing rig, and it's not a digital alien. It's a real life thing they built, but it was so rushed. They didn't have enough time to color it correctly to where it looks fake and it just looks awful. And he makes the movie and he says, okay, now I can get into editing. And the studio was like, no, you're not going to edit. You're not going to have a say over what we're going to do with the movie. So he wasn't even allowed to put together his own movie. And at that point, he said, you know what? Just take my name off the movie. And they said, no, your name's staying on the film. And but if you ever look, there's no interview of Alien 3. He never did anything about that movie because he always kind of says, that's not my movie. That was not my alien. movie I wanted to make. And,
but that's kind of like who David Fincher is. He's so, I don't want to use the word controlling because that sounds.
But
that,
he kind of is, though.
That sounds really bad, but he is. He's a control freak and has to control every aspect of the film, which is why he does so many takes, which is why he does so many different angles, so many shots, then why he does what he does in the editing room, because he wants to make the movie the way he sees it, the way he sees it on paper in his mind's eye. That's the way he wants to see it on film and in the theaters. And that's, I can understand why he would say that about Alien 3, because I would say that. I mean, that's studios interfering with directors happens way too often.
All the time.
And especially like you see that now with Warner Brothers in the DC universe. Warner Brothers wants one thing, the directors want another, and all 9 times out of 10 the studio is going to win because they have the money.
Yes.
So yeah, I don't blame David Fincher at all. I think he's utterly right for saying, hey, yeah, that's not my movie, because it isn't. Everything after Alien 3 is his movie.
But what makes me happy was he did 7 right after that.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes me like feel like he was flexing, like, hey, this is how good I am. I could have made y'all an awesome movie, but no, you just had to screw with me. And look, this is what I just did. Look at that. And that movie's awesome. And then from there, he just kept making hit after hit. And, you know, Fight Club, as amazing as it is, was not well-received when it came out.
No.
But over the years, it's gotten a huge following.
You know what's crazy to me about Fight Club is Edward Norton.
Yeah.
So Edward Norton, known to be kind of a diva. Like, yes. He is very, he's a control freak himself. He likes to control everything that goes on the set, especially in his scenes. He likes to have some creative input into whatever he's doing. That was his big issue with Marvel whenever he was the Incredible Hulk. They had disagreements on how they should move forward from there. I think he actually had a script written out for an Avengers film.
Yeah, he had a Hulk movie written, and he had the Avengers film written. He said, this is what I think the direction.
Yeah. And obviously Marvel had a different vision, so they went a different direction with Mark Ruffalo. Not mad at him at all. Mark Ruffalo was amazing.
Yes.
Is amazing. And I think what they made a great choice. But if you can just imagine how that interaction between David Fincher and Edward Norton went on set, like, because Edward Norton, he wasn't as famous as he is now when Fight Club came out, but he wasn't he wasn't a schmuck either.
He was, yeah, he already had an Oscar nomination that point. Yeah.
Yeah. So he knew what he was doing, but two control freaks in one room, two alphas.
Yes.
You know, that's just asking for some type of collision and some type of bad chemistry. But for some reason,
movie worked.
It worked.
Well, part of the reason it worked was because Fincher, Pitt, and Norton kind of rewrote the whole movie themselves. And again, you're probably right. Errol Norton was probably like, well, I think we're missing a lot of opportunities here with what we could do. And then it was like, okay, how can we make this work? And so they wrote a lot of the film themselves. And so part of me thinks that that's why he and Fincher got along so well, is because Fincher let him
go into the creative process.
Yeah, do his
thing. But I bet you Fincher was like, yeah, but I'm editing this.
Yeah, you're not. Don't come into this room, all right? I got this. And that always blows me away with Fincher is the visual effects he puts in his movies. Because I often say there's a couple of directors who do very good with visual effects. You got Robert Zemeckis, which I heard his latest one wasn't that great. But before that, Zemeckis was just amazing with visual effects. Steven Spielberg, James Cameron, and then David Fincher. And, you know, David Fincher, you don't think about with big visual effects, but man, the visual effects he puts in his movies are so subtle that, you know, you're like, oh, that's cool. Because he uses his visual effects to enhance the story. He doesn't just go like,
boom,
oh, check this out, this is cool. But no, man, like, his visual effects are there to, like, he likes the joke where he says he showed The Social Network. They played it at Harvard. Where the movie takes place. And he said, one of the guys there was like, that's not Harvard. And he was like, yeah, no shit. Y'all didn't let me film there. So he's like, that's on y'all. Okay. And he was like, you know, we had a skyline, but we had to digitally add in, you know, Harvard all around them to make it look as if we did film it there. And I was like, that's
That's incredible. And there's the opening shot of the movie with Jesse Eisenberg walking out of the bar and crossing the street. Looks just like a camera following him, but no, he was like, I had four cameras with this angle, this wide angle. And then what I did was I went into the editing and we spliced it all together to make it look like the camera doesn't move. And I'm just like, how do you,
that's crazy.
How do you even think about doing something like that? Like, it just, and then of course, Armie Hammer, The Social Network, had his face duplicated and all this. And I was like, I don't know. I love it though. That's what I love about Fincher's movies, is I love to see it because I'm like, okay, where's the visual effect at? Because it's there, but he hides it so well that he hates drawing attention to it, which is what I think works for his movies.
Yeah, and the other thing that I love about his movies, and you can take this to every single movie that he's made. It's not so much about the picture itself in terms of, you know, the sound or the effects or visual effects. It's about the characters.
Yes.
The character development in all of his movies is through the roof. And I know this is our second episode and you guys are just starting to get to know us. I'm really big on character development. I love to watch a good movie and just connect with the characters. And by the end of the movie, I want to be able to feel for him. Like I love that feeling of just growing with the character and experiencing the emotions that they portray on the film. And you see that in all of his films. And that's kind of just the one thing I love. And his genius in the editing room and filmmaking and what he does on set and behind the scenes are amazing stories. But what he's able to put on screen for the audience to see on how he tells a story and how he can bring a writer's story to life is utterly amazing.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Like, at the end of all of his movies, I usually have a emotion. It's I feel something at the very end. Like even The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and you see her all by herself walking away, you're like, oh my, like you feel it. You've been on a journey with these people. The Social Network, he's all by himself. He's the one of the youngest billionaires in the world. And there he is sitting all by himself on his computer, just wanting to get the attention of the girl who left him, you know. It's a little things like that just worked. But then you got The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which was kind of like just a slice of life, you know, but an extraordinary slice of life. We didn't really talk about Gone Girl, though.
Gone Girl was something else.
I liked Gone Girl. And I had just started talking to my now wife when that movie was coming out. And I was so excited because I was like, I'm reading the book called Gone Girl. And she was kind of like, okay.
That's kind of weird.
That sounds weird. And then my buddies worked at a movie theater at that time. And I was like, hey, guys, is the movie coming out soon? Can we watch it? Like, yeah, let's go. So we all watched it like 2 days before it even came out, late at night. And I was like, I'm going to go watch Gone Girl with my buddies. And she was like, okay. Like, she was all weirded out by it until it came out and I showed it to her. And she was like, like, whoa. I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
She was like, I thought it was a chick flick. I was like, oh, no,
absolutely not.
That movie was, that was a great film. Like,
it
that
really was.
And I'm shocked that it didn't get as much recognition as it should have gotten, but yeah, it's the Academy kind of, which makes me nervous with Mank, that the Academy's just got to kind of go like, oh, no, it's Fincher, it's okay.
The Academy, one, it's David Fincher. They're going to have to give him the props that he deserves, because people are going to say this. It's going to be like, oh, it's a lack of options. There's really nothing really else to compete with him, which is true. But at the same time, like, you cannot deny the greatness that happened with Mank.
Oh yeah.
And I tell you what, I'll go as far as this. If Mank had came out a year before in 2019 with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, with Joker,
with Parasite,
it would have blown all those movies away.
Ooh, that's saying a lot, man.
Joaquin Phoenix would not have won an Oscar. It would have been Gary Oldman.
And I would have preferred that.
I know you would have. That's another conversation.
That's another conversation for another time.
He was so mad. I should have made a bet. Anyway,
we should have made a bet. but I just found out today that Fincher's next movie is from the screenwriter of Seven. Like, they're finally connecting again to make another movie, and Netflix is going to put it out there. So that's
going to be amazing. And that's the whole thing too. And I think that's an episode that we'll do later on. Is like kind of the effect that COVID-19 had on 2020, and what does it mean for the movie industry? You know, we're now seeing these major streaming services bring out major motion pictures.
Yeah.
You know, Netflix is, it did Mank. They did a Scorsese film like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
In The Irishman. And now they're going to do another Fincher movie with the screenwriter from Seven, which is going to be an epic tale. I can already,
We already know.
We already know it's going to be amazing. But you also have Hulu having their originals. Disney Plus is going to have their originals. HBO Max is going to have their originals. Amazon Prime has been having their originals. And so the effect that COVID has had on the movie industry and the streaming industry is very interesting and very complicated. And then there's a very unique dynamic that's going to happen. And we're going to see kind of a shift within the next year of how movies get made and released.
Oh yeah.
You know, are we going to start seeing major studios doing what Warner Brothers doing, releasing their major motion pictures to streaming and theaters on the same day? Because they did it with the little things and they actually made a profit, to my understanding. So what does that mean going forward? Again, that's an episode for later on down the road. That's a whole other topic. Today was all about David Fincher, and I think we hit the nail right on the head.
Oh, yeah, I agree. But there is one cool fact about Mank that was so cool, I missed it, and I had to go and look it up. Oh, my God. So
he's going to blow my mind.
In the movie, they do show the Oscars at the end, and Citizen Kane only won one Oscar. It was for the screenplay, I love the epilogue, if you may, at the end of the movie. But the person who announced the Academy Award for Citizen Kane was Ben Mankiewicz, which is the grandson of Mank. That was his actual grandson. And so I thought that was really cool that they filmed his grandson calling out his grandfather's name to give him an Oscar. You know, I thought that was such a cool nod to, you know.
Such attention to detail on that. That's insane.
And, but yeah, hopefully, I mean, I don't know. You feel like we accomplished a lot today?
Yeah. I mean, I think we did pretty good. We're about an hour, 58 minutes in.
Yeah, 58. Yeah, David Fincher's one of my favorite directors of all time. And any movie he does, I'm there to watch.
You know, the last episode, we kind of listed out some of our favorite directors, and you listed David Fincher. And the more we talk about David Fincher, and I'm thinking, why wasn't he on my list? I don't understand.
Yeah, you start to go through your movies, and you're like, oh, that movie was cool. Oh, that movie was awesome. Then you're like, wait, why?
Now I have to rethink my life.
Now you have to rethink your entire life. But Mank was amazing. Go watch it. It's got to be an Oscar contender, as well as go watch all the other David Fincher movies. I'll put a list at the bottom to show you all the David Fincher movies that you should watch. They're really, really great.
And join us on our Facebook group, Movie Stuff Podcast on Facebook. We also have our Instagram page, Movie Stuff Podcast. Our Twitter page will be going up here pretty soon as well, where you'll see kind of news updates from the movie industries that we find online from our sources. Yeah. And then we'll also post updates as to our shows, when they're going to be available. And every once in a while, we will do a live show where you'll actually get to ask us questions and talk to us live online. So it should be fun. And hopefully I'm possibly thinking about making a TikTok, but I'm old. So see how that goes.
Yeah, we're old. We're not going to be doing any dances. So don't get too excited. But yes, thank you guys so much. And again, thank you for listening to our first episode. And we'll be back next week with another movie topic.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Have a nice, great week.